OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Shabbat Parshat Metzorah. But that Parshat HaShavua alone does not really tell you what the Shabbos is. It isn't Shabbat HaGadol, but it is. Shabbat HaGadol is the Shabbat before Pesach. This year, the Shabbat before Pesach is the day of the Seder, the Shabbat Erev Pesach, and the Shabbat HaGadol honors, as far as the traditional drasha, the major sermon of rabbis on Shabbat HaGadol, is preponed to this Shabbat. We at the Israel Center have a pre-Pesach Shabbaton. Our guest is Rabbi Shalom Gold, and he will be delivering a traditional Shabbat HaGadol drasha, albeit not on officially Shabbat HaGadol. So it is and it isn't, that's the story. The date on the calendar of this recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the fifth day of Nisan, 5768, and the 10th day of April. Just yesterday I had an experience which I've had before. A guy was writing out a receipt for me, and he asked what the date was. Very common. I said, it's the 4th. He said, no, it can't be the 4th. It must be like the 8th or the 9th. I said, no, it's the 4th. So he looks on a calendar. He says, see, I told you it's the 9th. I said, oh, were you talking about April? So then, after a moment's hesitation, he smiled, and he says, well, yes. And I said, no, it's the 4th of Nisan. He said, yeah, but... I said, what but? He says, I have to fill in the date on the receipt. I said, writing the 4th of Nisan, 5768, is perfectly acceptable in Israel, which is one of my favorite only-in-Israel kind of tidbits of information. Anywhere else in the world, you have no choice but to date the receipt the 9th of April. Here, you have a choice. And it is a wonderful thing to have that choice. And it is a very wonderful thing to be able to write the 4th of Nisan, or today the 5th of Nisan. Especially because the Torah says, HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem Rosh Chodashim. This month of Nisan is yours. It's for you. The rest of the world has their January, February, March, and April. You have Nisan as the first of your month. It's a gift from God. It is a reminder of the Exodus. It is a reminder that He took us out of Egypt. It is a reminder that He pronounced at Sinai, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mi'Beit Avadim. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Why? If we don't have to, should we date a today as the 10th of April? All right. Realistically, you have to do that. Sometimes. You're on an internet site and you're filling out information. You have to put in the secular date because the people that you are writing to don't know from Nisan. But here, you walk into a bank and there it smacks you right in the face. The date, 5th of Nisan, 5768, and then the 10th of April, 2008. And that's the order, and that's the priority. This is, of course, not the first time, or the second time, or the third time that I brought up this topic, but every so often it hits me, and every so often I like to share it with radio listenership of Torah Tidbits Audio and the readers of Torah Tidbits, the hard copy and the electronic version. So that's the story, especially since last Shabbat was Parshat HaChodesh, where we have that annual reminder of Nisan being the first of our months. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Nope, I take that back. We will do Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph, Psalm 121, as I have started doing here at the Israel Center on days when we don't say Tachanun, days with a little bit of a festive nature or more. And the whole month of Nisan is designated as the month of Geula, the month of redemption, and we don't say Tachanun. If we don't say Tachanun, we have chosen, at my direction, to recite Psalm 121 rather than 130. So here goes. Shir lama'alot, esa einai el heharim me'ayin yavo ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai, osei shamayim va'aretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha, al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yiminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach balayla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra, yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tzeisecha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Parshat Metzora is one of a pair of sedras that are sometimes read combined and sometimes separately. There are seven such pairs, which each has its own rules as to when they're combined and when they're separated. In the case of Tazria Metzora, it is very straightforward. In a Shana Peshuta, a plain year, a 12-month year, a year that has only 1 month of Adar, Tazria and Metzora are always read combined, and always after Pesach. In a Shana Meuberet, a pregnant year, sometimes called the leap year, a year that has 13 Jewish months, a year that has 2 Adars, Tazria and Metzora are always read separately. And it turns out that they are always read before Pesach. Specifically, Metzora is quite often Shabbat HaGadol, the Shabbat right before Pesach. And in this year, and in a similar year type, it is not quite the Shabbat before Pesach, as I mentioned earlier, but the Shabbat before. But it is still in close proximity to Pesach. Now, I'm going to share a thought, which I just want to give a personal background to. My bar mitzvah sedra was Tazria Metzora. So that was not in a Shana Meuberet, and it was after Pesach. My birthday is in the month of Iyar, and that's the Seder you read in those cases. So now it's coming early. In other words, it's not yet my birthday, but it is Parshat Metzora. The Haftorah this week is the regular Haftorah for Metzora, which is the one that I read for my Bar Mitzvah. And I had, in reflection, always sort of been a little, not quite resentful, but a little jealous of some of my friends who had juicy sedras for their bar mitzvah parsha, subjects that they could speak about, be it the Ten Commandments in Parshat Yitro, or Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea in Beshalach, and all kind of other good, juicy sedras. And I had Tazria Metzora, where the main theme, overwhelming number of psukim in both of the sedras, deals with tzara'at, which is some kind of leprosy, and nigaim, various and sundry blemishes to the body, and blemishes of the clothing, and blemishes of a house, afflictions of a house, and a little piece in the beginning of Tazria on a woman giving birth and being tameh. I did a count just out of curiosity, and I found that the word tameh for ritual impurity occurs in some grammatical form or another just in Parshat Metzora alone 44 times. 44 words in Metzora deal with some kind of ritual impurity. Tahor, purity, on the other hand, shows up only 30 times. So the Sedra is kind of a depressing, dark Sedra. And as I said, as a bar mitzvah boy, I was kind of jealous of classmates that had more interesting topics to speak about. Now, in my time, it was not that fashionable for a bar mitzvah boy to speak at his bar mitzvah, so I didn't. I read the Torah on Shabbat, and I read it on the Thursday before, and that was a standard way of celebrating one's bar mitzvah. But now, in retrospect, all these many years later, I find things in Tazria and in Metzora that I think are of interest and value to share. I'm not really saying that none of it is like that. It's all interesting when a person develops a mature, sophisticated approach to Torah. But I think you know what I mean. In any event, I'm now going to share with you a thought which really comes from a stream of consciousness, and I hope that I will be able to tie this together in a cohesive manner. I remember as a child, and later as a teacher of children, always concerned, being told to be concerned, or telling others to be concerned, about giving a good impression, and the opposite really, avoiding a bad impression of you, not only as a person, but as a Jew and a representative of the Jewish people and Jewish education and Jewish values. Meaning, a kid who wears a kippah and a group of children who are wearing kippot, when they are on a bus on the way to a class trip someplace, and they are rowdy, it's not, kids, look at the way kids behave. It becomes, in the perception of many people, this is my previous experience in New York, of, oh, look at those Jewish kids. Look at how they don't care about other people, and they put their feet up on the chairs or whatever. And we were always told, and I have always told people, to be on their better behavior, even though you would like to relax a little. You can't, because you represent the Jewish people, and therefore you have to hold a higher standard of personal behavior so as never, God forbid, to disgrace God's name or Judaism or whatever. Now, I'm not going into the psychological effect of this on a kid and whether we're overburdening our children with this. It's a fact of Jewish life. And you see it in some interesting ways in the Torah. For example, and this is where the thought came from, in Parshat Metzora, the topic of Nig'ei Bayit, afflictions of the house, is discussed. If a person sees a certain blemish on the walls of his house, now I think of this in terms of mold and bacteria and whatever you want to call it, signs of dampness, which in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, we were obligated to call a Kohen, expert in this topic of afflictions of the house, to see if we were dealing here with purely a physical thing, in which case you buy a good quality paint and paint it over, or if we're dealing with a physical slash spiritual kind of affliction that the Torah talks about in these sedras of Tazria Metzora. The Kohen comes and inspects, and he will declare the house okay, or tameh, or He will quarantine the house for a week and then come for a follow-up inspection to see if the signs of possible nega have changed in coloration, in size, in scope, or whatever. There is a concept, which I'm not really going into now, although I mentioned it, so we might as well go a little bit more with it. There is a concept of this bridge between the physical and the spiritual. In fact, let's go there for a moment. I was just listening earlier today to a radio mystery theater, an old radio show, not the very old ones, but the ones from the 70s and 80s, and of the 1900s, and the topic was of some psychosomatic illness or paralysis or injury. And it is well documented that there are people who have nothing physiologically wrong with them who exhibit some kind of paralysis, and it could be traced to a psychological cause. Cure the psychological problem and the physical symptoms very often clear up. In an analogous way, I'm not saying it's the same, but in some kind of analogous way, the topic of Niga'im, which was once upon a time, and I imagine in the future as well, temporarily we don't practice this for various reasons, but in the time of the temple there was a concept with a series of mitzvot attached to it of a physical manifestation which was traced to spiritual causes. If a person had a lesion, a boil, a blister, a bald spot, various types, and would show it to the Kohen, sometimes the Kohen would say, well, no problem, you're okay, just have it seen to, go to the pharmacy, do this, do that. In the case of Nig'ei Habayit, what I said before, call in a painter, he'll prime it with an anti-mold kind of paint, and then paint over it with some bright colors, and you'll be okay. But if the Kohen perceives, by his inspection, that this is a spiritual problem that is being manifest in a physical way, then it becomes forbidden to paint over it. It becomes forbidden to cover over or erase the signs of tzara'at on the body, on garments, or in a house. But it has to be treated the way the Torah prescribes. When the spiritual problem is on its way towards healing, then the person becomes tahor, his house can be rebuilt, whatever. And again, without having to go on and on about it, there is something to the connection between physical and spiritual, because that's what we are. Now, let's say, we don't, but let's say there was a book, a very special old sacred book, where you could consult the person who holds this book, the expert, the sage, the elder, and you could come to him and say, I fell and broke my arm. I want to know what it means. And he will ask questions, right arm or left arm, simple fracture or compound fracture, did it puncture the skin, was it infected, did it have this and that. When he gets all of the details, he opens the book, flips a couple of pages, looks around, and says, oh, here it is, a simple fracture of the left arm indicates that you don't say blessings before you eat food all the time. Start being more meticulous about saying a bracha for everything that you eat, and you'll see your arm will heal nicely. Now, we don't have such a book, and we don't have such a message directly, clearly like that from God. But we have a sense, which we learn from Tazria and Metzora, that such a thing exists, and in lieu of that book, we have a belief that in addition to treating a physical malady of any sort in a physical way, we also need introspection and self-improvement, even if we can't pinpoint the exact cause. Tzara'at, that the Torah was talking about, is generally blamed on lashon hara, gossip, evil tongue, speaking ill of people. But again, whether in the time of the active life of these mitzvot, it was a clearer connection. You have that deformity, or you have that problem, because you speak lashon hara, or because of sexual promiscuity, you have this and that or the other thing, or not. It's still tied there in some way. That's a message from Tazria and from Mitzora, that there is a physical manifestation possible of a spiritual problem. Now let's get back to my original point of the little kid being told when he goes to a baseball game he has to be on his best behavior, not because he's a little kid, but because he wears a kippah and he's a Jew. And that came from one teensy-weensy little fact. The concept, the topic of afflictions of the house applies only in the land of Israel. God says to Moshe and to Aharon, saying, Ki tavo'u el eretz Kena'an, when you will arrive in the land of Kena'an, asher ani noten lachem la'achuza, that I am giving to you as a holding, V'natati negat tzara'at b'veit eretz achuzatchem. It can happen that I will give you the affliction of tzara'at in those homes. The same kind of home outside of Israel does not have that physical spiritual connection. You can still get mold. It could still come from moisture in the walls. But it is not tied to a spiritual concept, except in Eretz Yisrael. There's a higher standard, and therefore we are treated tougher. Our homes are treated tougher in Eretz Yisrael. I thought then to generalize to the topic of ritual impurity. 2 weeks ago we had Parshat Para that discussed the kind of ritual impurity that comes from contact with a dead body. We're coming up to the halftime break, whether you listening to this or listening to the two halves put together without the material in between or not, there still is a break, so we'll be right back.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
We were in the middle of talking about the higher standards on a spiritual level that we perceive we are expected to maintain. Let's put it like that. A non-Jewish dead body imparts that kind of tumah from contact as well, but not in the same room, under the same roof, without the physical contact. That, from a dead body of a Jew can contract ritual impurity without even touching the body, just being under the same roof. And to me, it indicates a higher standard that we are being kept to. Briefly put, there is a Jewish perspective, and I say it like that without apologizing for it. I believe it, and this is our perception, that God expects all human beings in this world to behave as decent human beings with decent moral standards. And when a human being behaves like an animal, he will be held accountable to it by people as well as by God. You are not an animal, you are a human being, and you are expected to behave in a certain way. When it comes to the Jewish people, a Jew is expected to behave in a higher moral and spiritual standard all the way across the board. Of course, no person is allowed to kill, to steal, etc., etc. But there are other things of a spiritual nature which, according to Judaism, only the Jew is obligated on. Fasting on Yom Kippur. Fasting on Yom Kippur, if a non-Jew does not fast on Yom Kippur, we don't tisk, 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 how could you do a terrible thing like that? You see a non-Jew eating non-kosher food on Yom Kippur on your way to shul in the afternoon, you could say to him, B'tei Avon. You see a Jew eating on Yom Kippur, you can't tell him good appetite. You have to do the best you can to convince him that he's doing the wrong thing. I mean, that's just one example, and that's the short of it. It does not mean that non-Jews don't have standards of moral behavior. They do. They must. In fact, whatever society deems are part of that become part of the Noahide laws. It's a very flexible law called dinim, which means society can legislate and obligate from a religious perspective, again, according to the way we look at it, for all people. But the spiritual standards of the Jew who is commanded to become holy, kedoshim tihiyu, he is accountable on a higher level. Symbolically, the dead body of a Jew, which is the physical without that spiritual component of the neshama, the soul, imparts a greater level of ritual impurity than the body of a non-Jew, who still makes a person tamei from touching him, but not tumat ohel. I hope this is not taken the wrong way. It probably needs further clarification, but enough said for now. Of course, I had intended, which I hope to still do a little bit of, talk about the upcoming Passover, Pesach, but I want to share with you a lesser known mitzvah in the month of Nisan, which kicks in earlier from the first of Nisan. I remember when I first learned of the bracha that I'm about to describe to you, that I thought my teacher was putting me on. And I had that same reaction when I taught it to my students. If you know it exists, of course, then you're not surprised. But if you hear that there is a bracha to recite once a year in the month of Nisan, when you see fruit trees in blossom. Further details, if the trees begin to bear fruit, we don't say that bracha. If a tree has beautiful flowers but it does not bear fruit, then we don't say that bracha. The bracha is specifically said in the month of Nisan, preferably, or more than preferably, on fruit trees that will give fruit, and in the meantime, they are giving us a display of their flowers. I see this bracha as a wonderful celebration and recognition of the beauty of God's world. Here is a tree that in a month or two will give us apples to eat, cherries to eat, apricots to eat, whatever. In the meantime, this tree has already earned its keep because of the fruit that it gives us every year. Yet, in early spring, there is a magnificent display of beauty. Fragrant flowers, pretty flowers, as a bonus. It's as if God says, take a look at this tree. It's not just to give you the fruit. It's that you should look at it and smile. I'm editorializing on this a lot, but I get very excited about this bracha. It is said maximum once a year, and it is a pleasure to go out and seek the conditions for making this bracha. I had the privilege of doing it yesterday. I could have done it as early as Sunday, but I didn't get around to it. I must sadly admit, but I did say it yesterday on some cherry trees in blossom, and I wanted to share that with the listenership. The blessing itself has the standard beginning, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, God, Elokeinu, Melech HaOlam, our God, King of the Universe, Shelo Chisar BaOlamo Klum, who did not leave out anything from this world, Uvaravo Briot Tovot, and created in it good things, V'ilanot Tovim, and beautiful trees, or good trees, Lahanot Bahem Bnei Adam, that people can derive pleasure from them. Additionally, there are two psalms that one can say at the same occasion. It's nice to do this with a multitude of people. There is more of a joy in celebrating God and His nature. The two psalms are 122 and 128. But the bracha itself, the blessing itself, was not something I remembered from my early childhood. It's something I learned along the way, and I like to share it. I think that there is ample evidence, not just from this bracha, but from other things as well, that we very much relate to trees specifically and nature in general. There's a statement in the Torah, Ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh, for man is like the tree of the field. That's the Torah's comparison, and it has its context. The Gemara in Mesechet Ta'anit tells the story of it gives a mashal. I'll read it to you in English translation, and then I would like to play a song by a Shimon Kramer from an album simply called Kramer, with the words from this Gemara. To what does this compare? I think it was a person who wanted to thank somebody, and he didn't know how to express his gratitude for reasons that we will see. To what does this compare? To a hungry, thirsty, and tired person who was walking in the desert, who came upon a tree with sweet fruit and pleasant shade, with a stream running by it. He ate its fruit, drank its water, and sat in its shade. When he was about to leave, he said, Tree, O tree, with what shall I bless you, that you should have sweet fruit? Your fruit is already sweet. That you should provide shade that is pleasant? Your shade is already pleasant. That you should have a stream run by you? You already do. So I will say, may all cuttings from you grow to be like you. So too, how shall one bless a good, Torah-observant, happy Jew with a nice family? With Torah, he has it. Happiness, he has it. Children, he has them. Rather, may it be Hashem's will that your offspring shall all be like you.
Ilon, 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 Amo Avorechecho. Sheyehu Keiloi Sechon Esuki Aharei peiroi sechom nesuki Sheyehei silchon noe Harei silchon noe Oh yeloi hirotsoi Oh Shekhar Tiyon
Shimon Kramer with Ilan Ilan, Tree O' Tree. I think it's a beautiful way to say to God, thank you very much for this magnificent world in which you placed me. Somehow our experience this year with Purim, that in Jerusalem spanned the days of Friday, Shabbat, and Sunday, that became the attention grabber rather than general words about Purim. So too, Pesach has so much to talk about, yet the thing that stares you in the face this year, and knowing that it's not scheduled on the calendar for quite a number of years after this one, is the fact that Erev Pesach comes out on Shabbat. And it does a whole bunch of things. For example, it brings the search for chametz one day earlier, instead of doing it Friday night, which would be the eve of the 14th of Nisan. It's done on Thursday night. Burning of chametz is done on Friday morning, because you can't do that on Shabbat morning. Yet nullification of chametz is not done on Friday morning, but it is done on Shabbat at the proper time. The meals for Shabbat are very awkward, because people are all ready for Pesach, which means they're cooking Pesach-dik foods in vessels and pots and pans that are kosher for Passover, yet you can't eat matzah yet, and many people will have a side stash of some challah, some bread, rolls, pitot, to use at the Friday night meal and early on Shabbat morning, but they have to keep it away from their tables and away from their vessels. Others will use the Pesach alternative to bread, which still does not qualify as real matzah. It's known as egg matzah or honey matzah, and there's a whole halachic discussion of it, but let's suffice it. Now, my intention is not to review the details, but to make an observation. Shabbat day is not allowed to be used to prepare for the Seder, which is Saturday night, Motzoi Shabbat. Preparations are done before Shabbat. Whatever else needs to be done will have to wait until after Shabbat is over. So Shabbat is very much in the forefront, which this particular kind of year doesn't allow Pesach to sort of push Shabbat out of the way. It's too much there in our consciousness. And I think the same thing happens in a slightly different way when Rosh Hashanah coincides with Shabbat and we don't blow shofar on that day. this year with Purim in Jerusalem being on Shabbat. We didn't read Megillah on that day. We read it a day early. Lulav and Etrog are taken all the days of Sukkot except for Shabbat. And one should not see it as Shabbat being intrusive or bullying its way, pushing aside these mitzvot. No. Shabbat is such a crucial focal point of Jewish life and Jewish belief that when you're thinking even of the great holiday of Pesach, around which the whole cycle of the year revolves, we should not lose sight of the primacy of Shabbat. Shabbat is our weekly reminder of God's creation of this world, of his mastery of this world, and, as it says in the second version and presentation of the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments in Parshat Vo'etchanan, Shabbat also is because God took us out of Egypt, not just that he created the world. That's what Pesach is. Pesach reminds us in spades that God took us out of Egypt, so does Shabbat. So when there is a Shabbat that nudges for a more call to your attention in this situation where Erev Pesach itself is Shabbat, it's not now that you have to divide your attention between Shabbat on the one hand and Pesach on the other. No. Unify them by saying we exist as a nation, as a people, as a religion, because God took us out of Egypt. He gave us the Shabbat. He gave us the mitzvot related to the Chagim. He gave us the Torah. He gave us our reason for being a nation, that we were taken out of Egypt. That does not clash with Shabbat. Shabbat and Pesach go hand in hand. And maybe a token symbol of this is the fact that at the Seder, this Motzoi Shabbat, not this, next Motzoi Shabbat, we will say Kiddush for the Yom Tov coming. We will say Havdalah for the Shabbat leaving. We will not say these as separate ceremonies. We will say it at the same time with one cup of wine, not to economize and hit it two for the price of one. No, because the messages there interweave. And the token of that is the Kiddush part of this first ceremony at the Seder comes first, followed immediately by the Havdalah of the receding Shabbat, rather than the more logical, let's say, Havdalah, end Shabbat, and now we take our first order of business is the first cup of wine at the Seder, which is Kiddush for Yom Tov. No. Kiddush, wine, yayin, Kiddush, ner, candle, Havdalah, zman, shechianu, all rolled into one, interwoven, interlocked, because Shabbat and Pesach give us that same message. Hopefully next week the show will be very much Pesach-oriented. We will have many topics to discuss. I don't know how much Parshat HaShavua we'll get to, but Pesach will be very much upon us. I am sorry a little bit for not really spending more time with Pesach, but I think this first point of Pesach and Shabbat should get us started, at least from our perspective of Torah Tidbits Audio. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.